This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Better now that we're on. Cool.
Sorry, everybody.
Good work.
The,
People don't even know what you do, Nathan. You're just back there. Good work.
If I didn't need this computer, it probably would be broken by now.
No stress at all. None at all.
All right. All right, well, we've got a couple of questions today that we didn't get to last week, so we're going to try to power through those, and then if we can finish those, then we're going to get some more new ones that we've received recently. So we're just going to take it away and then go from there. Dr.
Good.
Lyle, can you briefly discuss the long-term psychological effects of frequent marijuana use? I know many people who are daily smokers, and I would like to know what arguments I could use to persuade them to stop smoking.
Oh, that's priceless. All right, let's see now. Let's see.
I'd like to hear this too.
Briefly discuss. Okay. Okay. Very brief.
It doesn't
How
have
about
to be brief.
Don't
worry.
Bother. Beat your genes. Really, I don't see how this is anybody's concern. This is a personality issue. This is not a knowledge issue. So people that are smoking marijuana daily, this is where they're at in their lives and who it is that they are. So this is a high openness, low conscientious, typical behavior. Now, obviously, there's going to be many exceptions to this, but that's essentially what you're looking at. That's sort of the epicenter of who's using marijuana on a daily basis. That's what it's going to be. So because you're not going to have typically high conscientiousness, you're not going to have people that are going to be interested in listening to detailed arguments about what's going to happen to them 20 or 30 or 40 years from now in terms of their cognitive function or various and sundry other things that may happen to them physically. They don't care, okay? That's what high openness is all about, is that we're willing to run risks that a normal person in the middle of the bell curve wouldn't run. So, and the low conscientiousness in general isn't going to help. Now, so my attitude is that this is kind of like, oh, I don't know, you got some friend, that works on the construction site with you, and he always stops, you know, and has like 3-4 beers a night on his way home. And he's not an alcoholic. He's not out of control. He just has 3 or 4 beers on the way home. That's what he does. And or actually, let's make him slightly higher in conscientiousness. He has 3 or 4 beers after he gets home. Okay, and he's 200 pounds, and he's 6'2", and he's a big strong guy, and he swings a hammer all day. I don't think that we're going to get very far telling this guy, hey, knock off the beer. You know, it's killing brain cells with every dose. It's statistically increasing your likelihood of cancer XYZ by, 28%, and et cetera, et cetera. It's like he couldn't care less. So he's running a cost-benefit analysis on his own intuition as to what the price is. And he doesn't see people flopping around like fish at 42 and with everybody pronouncing that they're dead from alcohol use. And the same thing is true with marijuana. So it's kind of interesting to me when when we the high conscientiousness side of the bell curve, as well as the media, who are nothing other than a bunch of fear-mongering, you know, manipulative creatures, which of course they would be. What we're going to hear is 38% more likely this, 72% more likely that. Well, if something's a chance of 1 in 1,000, then if it's 33% more likely than above baseline, it hardly counts. Like, what do we care if we go from 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 700? What difference does it make? So, I mean, it makes some difference, but only if you're a highly conscientious individual that is, you know, sweating fine details like this. So, you know, what are the long-term consequences of long-term marijuana use? Well, it's going to be probably very similar to long-term intermediate-level alcohol use. You're killing off some brain cells. You're undoubtedly increasing likelihood of various cancers, most likely in the lungs. Probably got some other toxicities that are going to impact you. There's actually some chances that some really unpleasant things will happen to you. So there's some evidence that a few genotypes are susceptible to long-term paranoia as a result of this. So, you know, not good, just as you'd expect any psychoactive substance to not be a good idea to be using on a consistent basis over any long period of time. But as I said, the people are not flopping on the ground at 42 as a result of 10 or 15 or 20 years of marijuana use, and everybody knows it. And we don't have raging, you know, increases of statistical likelihood of cancer, wiping people out consistently in their 50s as a result of long-term marijuana use. So once again, what people do is they survey their social environment and they look at what looks to be the long-term cost of certain what you'd call vices or risky behaviors, costly behaviors, and they run the numbers. And so this is also, you know, my vegan friends screaming up and down, you know, turning themselves into a pretzel, trying to tell everybody that, oh my God, what a disaster it is for your 14-year-old to eat cheese. It's like, really? Guess what? The whole damn country's eating cheese, and it's living about 80 years. So it's a little hard to try to get people to be freaked out about this. And the more hysterical you are, the more absurd it gets. Now, do you know that obviously it's going to, you know, have a slight but real correlation coefficient with health in general, and therefore it's worth a high conscientious person that is not that open and to be paying attention. And certainly, if a person's 55 and they're looking at 4 stents, it's time for them to wise up, read a book, and get intelligent about things, and cut the cheese out of there along with everything else that shouldn't be there. But in general, most people are not in a position where they are intimidated by the very mild correlation coefficients that they see between whatever habits that they have that are, you know, pleasure-trapping habits and any statistical risks that they run long-term. So they don't care, okay? That's an entirely different issue than some kid that comes to you and says, I'm in trouble. I've been trying to give this stuff up and I can't give it up. Okay, now, you know, clean the desk off. Get out a pad of paper, and we're going to start talking about a plan about how we're going to get out of a trap. That's a whole different issue. But trying to convince somebody else that is not interested in listening to this that there's dire long-term consequences, believe me, they can run the numbers, they can scan their social environment, they can come up with a pretty good guesstimate about what the costs are of this behavior, and if they're not intimidated by those costs, we're not going to talk it into them. Every 14-year-old has heard that drugs have risks and have impact on them. So I'm sure that who this person's talking about isn't talking about some 14-year-old. Probably talking about some 25-year-old. Well, that 25-year-old has their own opinions about what the risk-reward benefit is for them. And what's driving that risk-reward benefit is the pleasure-trap nature of the drug, their openness, and their conscientiousness. All of these, and God knows, other, you know, factors associated locally with their situation, who else they're smoking with, whether those people are cool, all kinds of stuff. But the point is that I wouldn't bother trying to talk anybody out of anything. And that would certainly include this.
Mm-hmm. And then what would you do in the case where someone says, hey, I'm in trouble, now let's work this out of the out of this trap?
Oh, well, I mean, that's every single trap is different, and every single person's different, and all the factors that are contributing to that trap working are different. So so that's where, you know, that's a clinical psychological puzzle for every individual. Mm-hmm. And so, I can't tell you exactly what I would do, because what I do with individuals are different in every single case, depending upon who that individual is and what their circumstances are. So I have individuals that I have talked to every day for a year, because that's how it is that we check in and that we maintain some subtle social pressure on them. So those talks don't have to be long. They're short, but they're a factor of constantly. It's kind of like if a person's teetering, they need a hand there to grab a hold to and steady them. Okay, so that's one way that I've done things. Other ways I've done things is have people call me the minute that they feel like they're in trouble, okay? And I encourage them heartily to do so that we are talking within an hour of when it is that they text me or let me know that they're shaky. So these are, you know, there's different, and then different plans for different people. In other words, we're thinking through where are the situations that you get into trouble, what gives rise to this, and we're anticipating them and attempting to plot around them. And so this is part and parcel of a lot of things that we do in order to deal with these issues. Yeah, high degree of client specific treatment plans for, you know, this kind of trouble.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always love hearing the on-air callers, because it feels like I'm a fly on the wall, and it's just kind of cool to see. So, okay. So our next question, Dr. Lyle, this question is about spousal abuse. Dr. Lyle, is it spousal abuse more a function of individual disagreeability and emotional instability and less connected to societal gender norms and values? As an anecdote, my wife has hit me a few times and she is one disagreeable lady. I shrugged it off because she hit like a girl. But thanks to your podcast, we are working on things.
Oh, man. I shouldn't get caught chuckling. None of us should, I suppose. But obviously, the horrific side of spousal abuse is male to female. Males are, in general, except in the case of my sister and I, the males are usually quite a bit bigger and stronger. But I grew up in a very intimidating situation. And so I learned to respect the female's muscles. My sister didn't hit like a girl. Yeah. So anyway, the questioner is correct. This is far more about personality than it is about cultural issues. Cultural issues are undoubtedly not entirely independent here. But they largely are, because even what you're seeing in cultures is largely the result of the personality of the peoples that are in that culture, and the personality of the peoples that are in that culture, i.e. what gives rise to that, quote, culture, is more behavior genetics than it is anything else. So the ultimately what's driving all behavior decisions, all decisions completely of all kinds, are cost-benefit analysis. So usually what you're seeing is, this is usually about men intimidating women into not leaving them. And so this is very much a personality issue. The person's exactly right. We're looking at disagreeable and emotionally unstable people. But that's not all we're looking at. We're looking at low IQ. We're looking at economic hardship. We're looking at fatigue, you know, alcohol, drug use, the fact that they may be over-rewarded in a relationship. We add that up, as well as the cost-benefit analysis with respect to the problem in that specific cultural context. So if it turns out that there aren't sanctions and there's no Leviathan government standing over the whole situation and protecting people that are weaker from the stronger, then we're going to have we're going to have more problems. So I have no doubt that as our government has become, in governments not just in the United States but around the world in certain locations, as the governments have become increasingly sensitive to this problem and have had increasing probability of sanctioning individuals who do this, I have no doubt that's contributed to a reduction in this over the last 50 years. However, where it still sits is it sits in disagreeable and emotionally unstable people, and it's particularly been facilitated by intelligence, by economics, by the perceived or subjected differences between the male and female about their relative mate value, particularly in the case of the male's subjective analysis of the likelihood of the female defecting, as well as other contextual issues. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of little factors that go into this, but the main factors, without a doubt, are a disagreeable and emotionally unstable male. That's going to be central to what it is that drives this. This is all about, incidentally, intimidating the female into altering her cost-benefit analysis about whether or not she's going to leave. There's a latent hell of a threat here. The latent hell of a threat is that, as the female may make half-hearted or suggestive movements that if you don't play more fairly within the relationship, I may leave you. When that results in the female getting assaulted, then you can better believe that this influences the female's statistical likelihood of displaying these in the future or following through because the latent threat is there. So this is precisely, and incidentally, this is a very much evolutionary, psychologically driven instinct. The male is simply, certain males under certain conditions are going to use this as an intimidating mechanism to keep control of a valuable resource, which is the female sexuality. So these, it's a hell of a thing to call an instinct, but and what we may more properly call it is a behavior that's resulting as to a constellation of instincts that are part and parcel of an overall cost-benefit analysis on a behavioral decision. And so, but that's what's going on there. The same thing is true of child abuse. So child abuse also is going to be a parent running a cost-benefit analysis on attempting to influence the behavior of a child. And once again, you're going to see disagreeable, unstable, low IQ, economic hardship, fatigue, drugs, et cetera. That we won't see over-reward there as a feature. We're going to see these other things, though, all being part of statistically increasing the likelihood of that behavior as well.
Fascinating. And when people engage in violence as a result of an argument, what is that? Is that more a function of trying to gain status physically, saying, well, you might be outsmarting me, but I've got more muscles?
Oh, you mean like in a male-female situation?
Yeah, male-female, male-male, female-female. But I'm not talking about a spousal abuse situation where someone's threatening to leave or altering the cost-benefit. I'm talking they have an argument and someone hits the other person, in essence, to try to gain ground on that argument.
Yeah, well, let's think about this. The arguments are generally they're conflicts of interest, and the conflicts of interest. I mean, there's usually something substantive about some decision and concessions that are going to be involved there. No, maybe not, but I mean, there generally are. And I mean, even if we're arguing over who won the MVP of the World Series in '54 in a bar, the argument is going to be about who is going to concede status. So, but mostly, in any argument that gets violent, is going to be more substantive than that. There's going to be a more potentially valuable resource that is in dispute. Okay, and so then the violence is essentially it's the follow through on anger, which is a threat that says you better back off. I'm being treated unfairly in this transaction. You better back off, or I'm going to impose costs on you for continuing to behave in the way you're doing. So it may be, for example, to shut down a continued insult. So some smarty pants who's making the big lug look like a fool in front of the girls is asking for trouble. The big lug will show his anger. He will threaten. He's not going to just he's not going to cheap shot him. He's going to threaten him. Hey, watch your mouth. Okay, so this is I can remember. I think what it was, Casino. What are you talking to me? more than one time they used that line. Like, hey, if you're giving me any crap, I'm warning you. There's going to be a problem. Okay, and so then the violence is a follow through on the threat. Very often, what's going to happen is that the hormonal mechanisms will kick in, and it will essentially guide the organism to making good on a threat if the cost benefit looks like it's the right thing to do. This is where it gets to be trouble with males, because there's a lot of potential genetic chips on the line and survival chips on the line. If you've gotten into a situation where the argument is heated and there are significant threats going back and forth, then if the other person is essentially gets the upper hand and it looks like they're going to intimidate you down out of your threat, then in order to maintain your credibility, you may need to feel like you have to follow through on this, because the cost benefit reaches beyond the current conflict and goes into a more systems-wide credibility issue with respect to your ability to threaten people in the future, as well as, therefore, your ability to do what we call resource-holding capacity. And so if the females see that you don't have resource-holding capacity, that the village males will call your bluff, then this is going to be costly for you in an unpredictable but significant amount of ways. And so the price is too high. So therefore, the organism, the computer, computational mechanisms of the organism activate, things like dihydrotestosterone and activate violent behavior. Just think of it as a machine that's a gambling device. And don't think of it as a human. And so it could, that same gambling device could be in a pair of halfway domesticated cats out in the middle of the street. It could be between a couple of water buffalo, and it can be between a couple of guys in a bar. Okay, it's also true that the alcohol will deactivate a lot of inhibitory mechanisms, making it far more likely than would have happened in evolution for a given altercation to escalate. So you could see that most of the time there would be quite a bit of inhibition on these things, quite a bit of threat, counter threat, and then face-saving concessions. Okay, but you could see also in certain circumstances where you would run the computation, where it's actually in my best interest, all things considered, to follow through on this threat, okay? And that's where you get the violence exploding. That's what causes it.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to turn the ship around a little bit and talk about OCD.
All right.
Hyperconscientiousness. Dr. Lyle, my partner has severe OCD. She cannot stop checking doors to the extent that she actually breaks them. Can this situation be explained by evolution, and can it be beaten?
Yes, it can be explained by evolution. Essentially, checking is something that you're going to see throughout the animal kingdom, of course, and that's because you better check, because that's a common solution for risk reduction. So there's going to be certain conditions where you're going to want to recheck what is it that you thought you saw or thought you understood to make sure, i.e. look both ways before you cross the street. Now, the tendency to do anything is going to be heavily influenced by genetic variation. So whether or not it's, if you like to box or you like to be, you know, paint, or I've got a kid who likes to make, you know, artistic things, the Monster Book of Monsters, of all things. Okay, so I got a young lady with a creative streak that just likes to do that sort of thing. So these are individual differences in people, and so there's going to be an individual difference in people checking things, and they're going to have, the reason why they're going to check is they're going to have anxiety, and that anxiety is going to be reduced when they check. Okay, it's going to sort of calm that loop. It's going to be like, okay, we thought we knew, but then we weren't sure. We infer a significant risk. Let's go back and check one more time. Aha, I checked one more time, and it confirmed what I thought the first time, closes the loop, and now what happens is other things in that person's mind that have priority over that risk that has now gone from, there was a 10% chance that I hadn't checked something important. Now that I've checked it twice, as I turn my attention away, the odds that I made the mistake twice and didn't quite get it straight is now 1 in 1,000, okay? So now I multiply 1 in 1,000 by the worst case scenario, and I get what it is. Even if I leave the stove on, what are the odds that the house burns down? Okay, not very high, but they're higher than it was if I don't turn the stove off. You know, what are the odds that somebody's going to come through that door and murder us all because I didn't lock the door tonight? Not very likely. Okay, extremely unlikely. But what are the odds? How much greater are they if I, you know, or how much mitigation if I lock it? Well, reduces it significantly. We've all got a few enemies, and some of those enemies have a few loose screws. So the somewhere, somehow, you know, you wouldn't want to leave your door open unnecessarily. So the wise person checks, okay, takes a look at that door, makes sure, before they go to bed at night. Now, the OCD person might check 5 times, maybe 10, maybe 100. Okay, so this is all going to depend on individual differences in the neural circuits of those individuals. Now, so it's genetic. The and I would say with CBT, I mean, we're not going to, I have not personally discovered an evolutionarily informed method for attempting to address OCD. So nothing leaps out at me. Most of the utility of evolution, evolutionary information on most problems comes from not reaching in and fixing some of these personality quirks. It usually comes from essentially understanding some common traps and distortions that inference-making mechanisms will give rise to. For example, the mismatch of the modern world and the Stone Age, a host of problems there. Useful understanding of things like man-woman dynamics, useful understanding of particular parental anxieties about child rearing, particular understanding of how to address esteem processes that are getting difficult or problematic, and how to understand that the other person, as a frantically greedy esteem machine that they are, how it is that we can essentially get a lot of peace in a system by using some techniques to mitigate some of those conflicts. Now, however, with OCD, this is a funny little personality quirk. This is almost like talking some girl that likes to dance out of dancing, okay, to try to talk somebody that likes to check out of checking. Now, can it be done? To some extent, it can be. Not that well, but it can be helped. And the tactic is going to be the standard tactic so far identified in cognitive behavioral therapy. It's actually more behavior therapy than it is, quote, cognitive behavioral therapy. It's more an issue of the person experientially essentially being strongly encouraged to face their worst case scenario of not doing whatever it is that they're doing compulsively, and by doing so, having the experience of going through an enormous amount of anxiety that will give rise to this, and getting to the other side of the anxiety and seeing that they're wrong. Now, what will happen if they'll do this repeatedly, they can, what's happening is that we've got essentially a classically conditioned anxiety reduction technique by checking. And so the problem is that the extinction burst in classical conditioning and the extinction of any conditioned phenomenon, whether it's Pavlov's bell for the dogs or whether it's cigarette smoking, or, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. If it's hand washing or stove checking or door checking for OCD, when you initially get away from something and stop doing it, there's going to be a tremendous extinction burst that's going to attempt to defend that behavior. And so you have to get past the extinction burst down into where we start to get into extinction. You won't get to extinction with OCD, but you can get it quieter. And the problem is that the person will inevitably have spontaneous recoveries. They'll have things that also give rise or cue that anxiety, and then they will very often recover that circuit. And so you're likely to have essentially a lifelong battle with this. But that doesn't mean that there aren't times, if you go to significant trouble and grit your teeth over several days in a row, that you can't get some of these things into essentially a partial extinction. That's the only way that I know. Now, some shrink will tell you to take Prozac, and I will tell you I think that's a terrible idea, and I don't trust that at all. I don't trust anybody's data that says that it's useful, and even if it is, that's like cutting off your finger so that you don't have to worry about the hangnail. Okay, I think it's a terrible idea. If you go to a psychodynamically oriented therapist, they're going to tell you the reason why you've got OCD is because you had overly severe toilet training. Okay, so forget about that. Their success is going to be exactly zero, although they will work diligently on it for 15 years for 3 times a week, and maybe sometime at the end something good will happen. Who knows? The solution to severe OCD is to not just talk to your garden variety cognitive behavioral therapist or someone that says that that's their orientation. The thing to do is to go to an OCD specialist in your city. Hopefully you live in a town that's big enough that's likely to have one. If you go to such an individual, after they stop counting all the little pencils on their desk, because they're very likely to be OCD themselves, after they do that, they will hopefully direct you with a firm hand towards facing your very worst fear and hopefully getting through the extinction burst that will allow you to get some relief.
Fascinating. All right, Dr. Lyle, we got time for one more, I think.
Good. All right.
Okay. Dr. Lyle, I'm having an issue with a friend of mine. This friend is very disagreeable and on a few occasions has outed me to large groups of people and put me in a position I don't want to be in. For example, at a party when someone asked me if I'd like them to pass the cheese dip, I was simple, no thanks, but my friend yelled out, Victoria, she's vegan. Or recently at a bar when questioned why I ordered a soda water and not a drink, I was fully prepared with doing your getting along without going along answer when my friend again announced, oh, but Victoria doesn't drink alcohol. I don't really like to announce these things for two reasons. I don't like the confrontation, and I don't want to deal with the esteem hit that they might take. And two, the resulting conversation that ensues when someone finds out about my differences has become an absolute bore. The thing is, when my friend does this, I know it's not malicious, as he agrees with my lifestyle and even has adopted some of the things I do. I want to talk to him about it, but I would imagine his response would be, well, why do you care what other people think? Because he doesn't care what other people think. How can I approach him about this in a way that he might understand?
Oh, he does care what other people think. Okay. Everybody cares what other people think, unless you're some autistic, you know, individual that has lost touch with all social reality. So, and he clearly cares what other people think because you're anticipating that he cares what you think if you're going to confront him on this. So let's not mistake the fact that what's going on here is you may not consider it malicious, but this is a motivated behavior for some reason in order to in order to enhance his own status. Okay, so if you're going to do something that's a little unusual, he might be liking to signal that he knows inside information on you. Okay, and he's willing to spill it. So that's he's indicating a closeness to you. Possibly this person's attractive in some fashion, and he's wanting to indicate that he is tight to the situation. Also, he may feel that your differences are not ones that he shares in terms of behaviorally, even though he not, may not, quote, disagree with it. He's maybe looking to give you a bit of a status hit, okay? He may not know why he's doing this. There's a whole hornet's nest of possible reasons. However, from my standpoint, I'm also interested that this individual has some trepidation about confronting him about this. Okay, so she's already sniffing that he's going to be disagreeable. Quite interesting. So what I would say is that you could be ready for this by saying that actually the issue isn't what I care about what other people think. It's about how I feel. Okay? So actually kind of what it is that I need you to do is to not do it. Period. Okay? And if he says, well, why not? You say, well, why should you? Okay, you've got a choice. You know, what's the point? What's in it for you and what's in it for me? Okay, I'm telling you, there's a cost to me. What's in it for you? Okay, this is like a 22-second conversation. It's checkmate. Okay, there's absolutely no reason for this person to do this. Now, like I said, there are reasons what's driving this, but we're going to go cut right to the quick. Why would you do it? What's the benefit? I'm telling you, to me, there's a cost. So what's the benefit to you that outweighs my cost? Okay? So we start friendly. We say, listen, I've noticed that you do this, and it makes me uncomfortable, and, you know, I just want to let you know, I know you don't mean anything by it, but I'd like you to not do that anymore. Okay? And I'd really appreciate it. Done. Nice and simple. Not asking a question. We're giving him a free pass, and then we're telling him that it's all cool, but we want it over. Now, if he says, well, no, wait a second, what should you carry? So, you know, it's really, quite frankly, I don't need a reason. Okay, I just don't like it. So I'm asking you to do this. Okay, is there a problem? Well, I don't see why. Like, well, you know, here's the deal. It's a cost to me. I don't like it. So why would we do it if there's a cost to me? I'm telling you there's a cost. Why would you impose that on me? Okay. Right now, he needs to be prosecuted. That's how that goes. Okay. So we start out friendly. We're cordial. We let him off the hook. And if we get any pushback, he gets checkmated. And I could checkmate that behavior in 18 seconds. No problem. Nowhere for him to hide. What's in it for you? I'm telling you to not do it because it makes me uncomfortable. That should be a good enough reason for you not to do it. Now, why on earth would you do it if I'm telling you that it's uncomfortable for me? Why would you do it? You know, just being friendly. Well, that's okay. That's not good enough. Okay? So we start friendly. We're pleasant enough. We let him save face. He doesn't mean anything by it. We understand that, but it makes us uncomfortable, so we're asking them not to do it. Okay? Done. We get pushback. We're not taking pushback. So if this it's completely unreasonable behavior on the part of this individual doing this. So this is absolutely imposing costs on our questioner for their own gain. Okay? And you know that same very disagreeable narcissism that is essentially imposing that cost is the same narcissism that this questioner is predicting that she's going to run into when she confronts it. Okay, so Victoria, you know, take heed. This individual, you know, if you're going to hang with them and they're your quote friend, we're going to see what how good a friend they are when we indicate to them that this behavior isn't wanted, it's not appropriate, and that if they continue to do it, you know, there's going to be a threat. And that threat is, you know, I don't need friends like this. That's how that goes. All right, good. I vented my spleen on that.
So in general, with friends, is there a strategy for when there's some conflict, the escalation of things? I mean, we kind of got it from there, where it's you're friendly first, then the next step is, you know, you just keep amping things up. And at what point does it become, all right, that's it, we're not friends anymore?
It depends upon, you know, this isn't someone super intimate, or this, you know, I can't believe that we hadn't had knockdown dragouts about this till now. Obviously, arguments in general, conflicts of interest in general, strategies that we have for when things can get heated, when there's some, you know, serious disagreement and people are facilitated. We know that human beings aren't perfect. We're not a bunch of, you know, Buddhists sitting there, you know, beating a little drum and humming and acting like we don't have any feelings. We do. Okay? And we're going to sometimes get a little out of line as we start to push our agendas. We're going to feel edgy, and we're going to want to threaten. That's natural. We're going to feel unfairly treated, have our anger activated, and then we're going to threaten. Okay? Now, the thing is that what we want to keep in mind is that that very often we don't understand exactly what the other person is saying and why they're saying it. And so sometimes our estimations of what's causing this conflict are a little bit off. And they don't have to be off by too much to make a big difference. So we may have forgotten some benefit that we've gotten bestowed upon us from somebody, you know, 13 days ago. And we forgot that we promised a little something. And now they're pissy with us now about something. And we're feeling like, wait a second, how come you're out of line? And the answer is they're not out of line. Their frustration is boiling up a little bit because they've got an uncollected debt. And they're a little too shy and a little too nervous and maybe in a position of weakness in order to tap us on the shoulder and remind us of it. For example, I'm just coming up with a scenario where this kind of thing can happen. And so as a result, the pissiness we see or the unreasonableness we see out of somebody may not be for exactly the reasons that we think it is. And so we're surveying a conflict and we're saying, hey, they're out of line. Okay? And so as a result, we attack back by saying, hey, you're being unfair, you're irritating me, and now we get a problem. So, God forbid, you know, I've promised people things, you know, 4 months ago, forgot about it, and then it's no surprise that they kind of quietly might be frustrated with me, and it's like, oh, God, you know, I can think about things like that with kids that I was, you know, a quasi-father to and just forgot about things that I said. And so, you know, the cats will let you know. Anyway, that's why we have in our mind, we're in conflict, we got to go to crystal clear. So crystal clear is where we essentially use a Socratic style method of, you know, calming down and saying, listen, I want to understand what your point of view is here. I'm not understanding. So let's go step by step. And this goes under a more broad philosophy of problem solving in general that I call don't skip steps. If we're looking at an argument, here's the deal, folks, that if there is a conflict in how it is that we view a critical negotiation, then it will remain there after we have shed all possible light on it and gotten crystal clear. Okay, so there's plenty of time to talk about and yell about or posture about how they should see things differently once we fully understand why they see things the way they see them. That's why we go to crystal clear. Okay, in Crystal Clear, it's very likely that we're going to uncover some nuances about why it is that they're running their judgments about things that are a little different than we thought. And so that's going to, like I said, even a little shift can make a big difference in how it is that everybody feels. Okay, so that's why we do that. That's why, but in this case, I mean, I am doing that. So we're saying, hey, you know, I understand this, that you've done this, no problem. I understand you don't mean anything by it. Give them a pass. Okay, it makes me uncomfortable, so I'd like you to ask you, you know, just cool it on that and not do that. Is that okay? Just like that. Okay, so the if the person defends that behavior at that point, boy, you know, if it was an intimate partner of significance, we'd go to Crystal Clear. So let me get this straight. You explain to me why this is, that this is such a good thing for you, that you really enjoy it. Okay? You know, I want to hear, what's the benefit? Well, sometimes I just think of it, but this is not a random thing that you're saying. You don't just call out, you know, who you think won the MVP of the World Series in 54. Why are you calling out what it is that my personal business is? Okay? So in other words, if we need to, we can go to Crystal Clear. When you go to Crystal Clear, you can be pissed, okay? But your job is still to be fair and to be questioning, to understand, okay? I.e., I'm pissed at you, and you can tell that I am. And my irritation hasn't entirely left my voice, but I'm also being calm and reasonable because I'm giving you some degree of the benefit of the doubt that as I dig through here, there's going to be an explanation that makes sense to me. Okay, that's what it is. And it's like I'm going to keep digging until I can feed back to you exactly why it is that you're reporting, why it is that you're doing what you're doing. And when I do that, it's either going to hit all the notes inside your subconscious, so they're going to say, yes, that's exactly why I do it, or it's going to not quite hit all the notes, and it's going to help facilitate for you the retrieval of additional factors as to why it is that you're doing it. Okay? So then you can report those factors, and then we can get further crystal clear. And once I get it all out on the table, then I can see the situation from your perspective, and then I'm going to have possibly a different view about the entire conflict of interest. Okay? And if I don't, and we've reached essentially a significant disagreement on an issue, then I'm going to say, hey, right here, I disagree. I really don't think that it's appropriate that you have the right to just say things about my personal behavior that aren't well known and I don't want advertised. And if you think that you have such a right, then you know what? I don't need to be around you. Okay? I.e., I'm still ready to level the threat after I more fully understand what, you know, if the person doesn't back off and essentially defends that position under the cross-examination of Crystal Clear and does not understand my position that I'm laying out, well, then at that point, I still have every reason now to be pissed off and to confront the issue and threaten them with consequences. So, i.e., if you don't back off and do this, then, you know, I will have to sue you. I don't want to. Okay? I don't want to do it. But if I have to, I will. Okay? And that's the notion of how I would deal with conflicts in general. Okay?
Fascinating. All right, Dr. Lyle.
All right.
Excellent. Love it, as always. We'll look forward to hearing some more next week.
All good.
And we're wishing everybody a good rest of the week. Dr. Lyle, thank you again, as always, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Nathan. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.